Frank Lavin's dad, Carl, was a kid, barely into his 20s, when he headed off to war, a foot soldier like millions of others.
And they perform. They do their job. They show courage. They show discipline. They show cohesion. And it is pretty impressive that they get it. They get what's at stake and they, you know, show their stuff. Now, at the same time, they're still teenagers. You know, there's always somebody who wants to cut corners. There's always someone who might not be telling the whole truth to their mom. There's always someone who's trying to get double rations and chow line. So there's always that sort of teenage atmosphere overlaid. But boy, there's an incredible sense of performance and of duty among that generation.
You mentioned after the war, your dad, when the shows would come on that you and my husband love, combat and all those, when those shows would come on, he'd leave the room.
Yeah.
Or he'd say, that doesn't happen. You talk about that contrast between our image and his reality.
Yeah, look, the movies and the TV shows, particularly in the 1950s and 1960s, I think he thought were very unrealistic. They romanticized combat. They romanticized heroism. And he just didn't feel comfortable even watching it. And I think he was a little uncomfortable. We were watching it as kids. The movies became a little more realistic in recent years, the Tom Hanks movies, the Steven Spielberg movies, the Ken Burns documentary, The War, where you could say, look, regardless of how noble the cause, this is horrific. I mean, terrible things are happening, and mistakes are being made, and it's just a mess. And that Sherman statement, war is hell, holds as true today as it did during the Civil War. So he had no appetite for any movie that glorified war or any movie of triumphalism. He thought that was not a healthy emotion to develop.
Can you talk about some things you found in the letter that really crystallized for you what stood out for him in that experience?
Well, it's the juxtaposition, ML. It's every day is somebody trying to kill you and you're trying to kill someone else, the most serious undertaking a person can perform, and it juxtaposed against superficial or silly things. I remember one episode he describes where he says the squad leader, sergeant, told a bunch of them that they'd seen some people moving on a tree line a few hundred yards away, clearly a German patrol of some sort, go and check it out. And these kids go out there knowing they're going to get 50% casualties, but every single teenager does it. And at the same day, a company medic comes by, or battalion medical officer comes by, and he says, some of you guys are behind on your shots. And every single kid lies to the medic, and every single kid complains. So at one moment, they really are heroes, you know, facing a very deadly situation. Later that same day, they're all basically teenagers saying, I'm not going to go get a measles shot.
Your dad is a Jewish kid from the Midwest,
yeah,
fighting in Europe against the backdrop of the most horrific event ever. Did that play in any way you could tell in his story?
Yeah, there's a few interesting things. One is he takes a very detached view of what's going on. It's a very mission-focused view. It's not an emotional view. I hate Hitler. I hate the Nazis. It's we're doing our job, and our job is to beat these guys. So his entire sort of written approach to what he's doing is professional, dutiful soldier. Even when after the war's over and he has the chance on guard duty and various assignments to talk to Germans, he takes sort of a journalistic view about what were you doing, why were you doing it, what was the point, and he's not full of rancor and emotion. But look, we know it was horrific, and there's one moment that reveals this, because the first death camp that is liberated by the Americans is a Buchenwald component called Ordov. Eisenhower visits this place. Eisenhower takes Patton and Omar Bradley with him so that all of his top generals see this. The other thing he does is he sends a note through the U.S. Armed Forces that he invites any Jewish GI to get a half day's leave, and they'll put you in a truck and we'll take you so you can walk through and see this yourselves. And Carl's called into the captain's office to say, fellas, here's a note from Eisenhower that if you want, we'll, you know, truck you over and you can see this. And Carl said, at that time, he just couldn't. He could not do it. He'd seen nothing for months but death and people getting killed, people wounded, and just terrible parts of war, and he just had no appetite for seeing something arguably even more terrible, so he declined the he just didn't have the stomach for it. Now, he said he subsequently regretted that. Just for a matter of history, he should have gone to see it, but he just didn't have sort of the mindset to prepare himself for how low humanity could go. And that this was a sort of a backdrop of everything they were doing.
For somebody who doesn't have a direct connection to World War II, what do you want them to find in this book?
Well, I'd say there's two or three things that people can take away. You know, if you're more of a political scientist, you say our world today is still defined by World War II. NATO, the United Nations, the GATT, now WTO, all of the Bretton Woods institutions, all of these relationships came out of World War II. And it was World War II that we, as a nation, first decided we needed to have peacetime allies we never had before. We needed to have overseas deployment we never had before. So our global posture, for good or wrong, all came out of that. And I think that does help you understand where we are today by looking at where we were 70 years ago. But then I'd say there's a personal story there, too, that many people appreciate. And even if you don't have a personal connection or family connection to the war, there's a core lesson of this book, which is history is sometimes a very top-down history. What was Eisenhower doing? What was Churchill doing? What did Truman decide to do? And all of that's very important. But the ultimate success on the ground is made up because of 1 million or 2 million GIs. And they are kids. They are teenagers. They're trained. They're motivated. They've got a rifle. But it's how they perform that ultimately decides the outcome of the war. And it's also these are the folks who pay the ultimate price. So I would tell anybody in senior policy decisions, yeah, you need to think of grand strategy and the outcome of the war, but you also need to think of the GI and the price that family is paying, the price that individual is paying when you make these decisions to put people into war.
Frank Lavin says that over the decades until his death in 2014, Carl Lavin described himself as lucky. Frank remembers him as serene and a man who led an active and optimistic life.